Whistleblower Report, exposing lies, deceptions, and all that has assaulted our way of life. We must take back our freedom and live as God designed in a free America that honors our Constitution and our Creator. Our experts in medicine, ministry, law, military, environment, and education empower us to grow together as a nation. For such a time as this, the Whistleblower Report offers truth and solutions. Welcome to the Whistleblower Report. This is Dr. Lee for America with the international team of Dr. Yeadon and Dr. Gilthorpe joining us from Spain this week and Sweden. Two quite extreme climates in the winter, sunny in Spain and cold and gray in Sweden. And cold and gray has been part of what we've been seeing in southern Arizona, with the escalation of the chemtrail spraying, altering our climate for the last year. We'll have a sunny day, bright, sunny, typical southern Arizona winter day, clear, blue sky, and then suddenly there are the planes crisscrossing the sky with these horrific chemtrails that don't disappear. And for everybody trying to say these are contrails, I know the difference. Contrails are water vapor from a jet on a flight path, and they disappear very quickly, and they don't stay around and coalesce into dark gray clouds that cover the entire sky, which is what's been happening in southern Arizona for the last year with the chemtrail spraying, altering by design our southern Arizona climate. And that has been happening a lot lately, causing sky to sky, horizon or to horizon, dark gray clouds, rain, cold, and dimming the sun, as Bill Gates has bragged he wants to do. I spoke with an expert about a week ago who said they have already achieved an 18% reduction in the sunlight reaching the earth. That's very chilling. And we're going to talk a lot about that in the second half of the show and what are some of the health effects of that. But that raised the question, the big question for our Whistleblower Report team. Why do people agree to carry out such horrific acts that are affecting other people? Why are the pilots? That was the question Dr. Yeadon asked me before we came on the air. Why are the pilots getting up in these planes and spraying this stuff that's affecting the health of everyone on the ground, affecting the climate, affecting animal life, plant life, everything? Why are the pilots doing it? I couldn't answer the question. I wouldn't do it. And I'm sure many of you listening wouldn't do it if you knew that what you were spraying was toxic to people and toxic to the environment. But then that led us into a discussion of even bigger questions, which we've all been seeing play out over the last 4 years. My question all along has been, why were doctors and nurses following COVID protocols dictated by the government that were contrary to the way we practice medicine, taking care of people in the hospital for respiratory illnesses for my whole career? Why were they doing that when they could see that people were dying at greater rates than ever in their careers? How could doctors and nurses inject morphine, fentanyl, midazolam into people with respiratory compromise, already having trouble maintaining oxygen, when they knew it depressed respiration. That's been the standard of care for the whole time I've been in medicine. Why were they giving an experimental drug when they knew we had effective antivirals? Why were they withholding antibiotics? Why were they withholding diabetes meds? Why were military officers ordering an experimental COVID shot for everyone and blanketly denying religious exemptions enshrined in our Constitution and the military uniform code of military justice regulations? Why were military officers punishing people for not getting the shot? Why are judges failing to rule on the point of law? Why are Border Patrol agents, who were good people who'd been in the Border Patrol enforcing the law for their whole career, why are they suddenly participating in breaking the law and escorting illegal aliens across our border, knowing they haven't been vetted for whether or not they are terrorists or on a terrorist watch list? They haven't been screened for medical conditions like legal immigrants are required to do. They don't have any papers or ID. Why are good people, sheriffs, police, Border Patrol agents, military officers, lawyers, judges, doctors, nurses, why are pastors lying to their congregation saying the shots are safe and effective when they know they can read the data that these shots are killing people and injuring them? And then they are making it a requirement, you have to be vaccinated to come to my church. Not all of them, but many. This is absolutely one of the most horrific times in my lifetime, watching good people turn against other people and carry out draconian measures they know are harmful and carrying out unlawful orders. What is the psychology behind that? How can people do this? I would have a hard time causing pain for an animal or a patient, even if I were trying to help them. But to do so knowing that it's causing harm, knowing that someone is suffering, I couldn't do it. I don't understand the mindset of those who have carried out these horrible COVID death protocols and the unlawful orders, and how Border Patrol people can be escorting people across the border they know are gang members and criminals. It's just horrific. So that's why we wanted to discuss this with you today. And there are classic experiments in the field of psychology, psychiatry, the compliance experiments. If you want to Google a subject that will take you down an interesting journey of what we know about why good people do bad things like this and cause harm to others, these compliance experiments over decades in the field of psychology and psychiatry will help to explain a lot of this. And we're going to focus on two of them in the first half of the show. The classic Milgram experiment done at Stanford University in 1963, and the Ash experiment. Dr. Yeadon's going to talk about the Ash experiment, and Dr. Gilthorpe's going to explain more about the Milgram experiment. I wanted them to weigh in on it as scientists. I'm familiar with both of these from my training in medicine and behavioral medicine. But I think it's really important that we hear what they have to say as scientists who design experiments, who understand experimental design, and can speak to what was the mindset of the people who designed the study. What were they looking for? And what did they find that shocked them? So let's start with the Milgram experiment, Dr. Gilthorpe, and tell us more about exactly what they did and what they found.
Yes, Dr. Lee, thanks for having me on the show again this week. So just a declaration, I'm not a psychologist, but I think as as many of us have that have realized how badly things are going in the world since COVID happened, many of us have become kind of amateur psychologists because we really have sought, at least if we have an inquiring mind, we've sought to understand, as you said, what happened here? How have we gone from this situation where the world was buzzing along, everyone was quite happy, there weren't any great problems in the world, to suddenly standing on the verge of being taken over by the WHO and the UN, on the verge potentially of World War III, and everyone now having their health threatened by mandatory vaccinations, which are on the horizon with totally new RNA products, which, to all intents and purposes, hadn't been invented 4 years ago. So this Milgram experiment is one that's quite often cited. It was called the Stanley Milgram shock experiment. And I think actually
Got it,
it,
Dr. Gilthorpe, before you go into the details on that, I want to just mention something. You made a disclaimer that you're not a psychologist, and I know that, and our listeners who've read your bio know that. But I think what's important that I want our listeners to understand about why none of us are psychologists, but why we are talking about this. You are talking about it from the standpoint of a scientist who spent a career in the field of designing experiments to answer good questions. The experiment itself is easy for lay people to understand, and all of us are looking at these experiments and the events around us from the lens of not psychology, but from common sense. And from the sense that we've lived in societies that had a rule of law and an order and a civility. And all of that has been upended in the last 4 years. So that's why what you have to say has its own credibility, independent of any formal training. You don't need to be a psychologist to read this study, understand the findings, and see how it relates to what's been going on around us. And that's what I want all of our listeners to do.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. I appreciate your faith in me.
Well, no, you're an intelligent person.
Well, and it's important so for people to understand, I think. So these many psychological experiments were done in the 50s and 60s, and a founding, I guess, reason for a number of these was World War II. The way that Nazi Germany had behaved and had essentially, particularly against Jewish people, the Holocaust, which some people are skeptical about, but I don't think you can deny that, Jewish people were carted off in trains and treated horrendously by the Germans under World War II. And then the flip side of that, of how the German nation, as it got back on its feet after World War II, because it was completely obliterated by the Allies, and a lot of atrocities committed by the British and the Americans in Germany after the war had been won, in inverted commas. So how did those people, deal with that understanding that they had been complicit in genocide? And I think it was very, it's a very interesting and important story, because this was a too big a problem for Britain and the US to manage. How could they prosecute millions and millions of people that have been complicit in genocide? They couldn't. They had to fix it some other way. And I think what we're seeing now, if we come back to your original point, is why people in the West behaved in a certain way when the pandemic came. Why did people not stand up and say, hang on, I don't agree with this? I think a lot of this is actually rooted in this, almost guilt that's permeated Europe, at least since the Second World War, where second or third generation after that, don't. There's some kind of deep-seated guilt, I think, there within Europe, and the idea that right wing, anyone that stands up for their own or their family's rights is somehow right wing. This is the way it's been painted over the last few years, that extremism, right wing, Nazism, is, and I think there's something there to unpick, but we can take that another time, maybe. But But that was a way of getting around to this point. So the Milgram experiment, actually, I think it was done at Yale University. At least Milgram was at Yale, not at Stanford, which I'd thought originally. I gave you a wrong line there, Dr. Lee.
Thank you for correcting that.
So he was interested in this obedience, the psychology of obedience, but essentially after World War II and the Nuremberg trials. And one of the Nazis was committed to death sentence, I think, in 1961, Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem. And then Milgram devised this experiment to try and answer the question, how could it be that Eichmann and the people that were following him, that in the Nazi regime, were just following orders? Or were they accomplices, or were they, just doing as they were told? So he wanted to investigate whether Germans in particular were kind of obedient figures, or show this obedience to authority, which is a well-known phenomenon and something that we've seen a lot over COVID. That, if Fauci says do this, people will do that because Fauci said this, and somehow Fauci is an extremely smart human being. Well, he's not. He's just a man, and he's a very corrupt and devious man. But we build up these concepts that people are authority figures, and we tend to do what they suggest, and this is called obedience to authority. So Milgram selected people for this experiment by advertising in a newspaper. I think he only selected males to take part, and I'm not exactly sure why he did that, but I guess it's because women have perhaps potentially much stronger maternal feelings. I don't think women are necessarily likely to behave in the same way in men in this particular situation. And what he did was to pair up the participant with another person, and then they drew lots to find out who would be the learner and who would be the teacher. And he fixed the draw so that the participant that was selected was always going to be the teacher, and the learner was one of Milgram's kind of stooges, his person pretending to be a real participant. And then what he did was to put the learner in a room and had electrodes attached to his arms, and the person who was selected to be the teacher, so the real experimental subject, went into the room next door, and they had this device which could give an electrical shock to the person in the room next door, which went from, maybe 10 volts or something, a slight shock, up to a much higher level of 300, 400 volts, which would cause severe injury, and then even a higher level, triple X level, which would give 450 volts, and that would potentially, kill the person on the other side. And the shocks, the important thing to understand, that there were no real shocks here. There was an actor and a person that thought they were giving shocks. So the teachers, the person that was the experimental person, believed this was going to be real. And that this was what the experiment was to set up with. How far would this person go into, injuring, sham injuring, or really injuring this person in the next door room? And obeying instructions that he was given to harm somebody else. And essentially what the experiment showed was that, well, people will go to extreme lengths to deliver a deadly shock to a person on the other side of the room, even when that person on the other side of the room is obviously in pain. The experimenter will do what the teacher, the person who has direct control, or theoretical control over this person, tells them what to do. And I don't think everything we've seen under COVID is explained by this Milgram experiment, because in many cases you have people acting independently without a directly a teacher telling them what to do. But at some level we have had this confirmation to authority. Either it's an individual, or it's someone within a hierarchy, or it's an institution like the CDC or the FDA or a government. But basically what the Milgram experiment showed was that two-thirds of participants would continue up to the highest level of pain for the person that they were giving it to, and all of them went up to the next highest level, so where you would cause serious injury. And he carried on. Milgram did the other variations of the experiment. People can go and read about this if they would like to know more. I think the conclusion, though, so the individual explanation for this behavior that the participants show was there was something about them that would cause them to obey, and why they would do that, I don't know. I don't really know the deep psychology of this, but I know that it's a well-known phenomenon that people will tend to obey authority in that situation where they're in a hierarchical arrangement with people. I think that's pretty
Yeah.
much. Mike, you want to add in
Yeah.
some more?
No, I think you did that extremely well. Yeah, so this is Mike Eden, as Jonathan, thank you. And also Dr. Lee, thank you for just sort of setting this up, because we were before this call, ladies and gentlemen, we were in angst saying, what the hell? And then we fell into this conversation. We thought we should record this. So yes, I think the important thing in the case of the Milgram experiments was that the participants believed that the authority figure had the authority to give them instructions. That was the setup. They were told that the person running the experiment is in charge. You're not expected to do anything except follow the instructions. And less than a third of the people would get up eventually and say, to hell with this. Most people, given that setup, there's an authority figure who presumably knows what they're doing. You keep following the instructions, and you can see that. You can go and watch these videos; they are recorded. I watched it. I remember seeing it as a teenager, or maybe early 20s, and thinking, "God, I wouldn't be like that." It's like everybody who watches it thinks I wouldn't be like that, but they tried to take a good size sample of people who that did not exhibit obvious psychopathy. They tried to find like ordinary people. And two-thirds of Americans in the 1960s were willing to turn the dial to a point where on the dial, on the board in front of them, it said potentially lethal. And they pressed the button, and then the guy on the other side went silent. They were willing to kill. And they were obviously distressed, but they did it. And so that's a very good setup. And there are many experiments, but there's another one in addition to Milgram. And I didn't realize this until we were just reading. There's another psychologist. So Stanley Milgram is the one whose most famous experiment Dr. Gilthorpe's just described. There's another psychologist called Solomon Asch, ASCH. And it turns out he was the PhD supervisor of Stanley Milgram. So in the late 50s, this man who, as Jonathan said, who's just torn, how is it that people conformed when? Why was that? Had they kind of failed to realize that things were wrong? And so he devised an experiment, which I shall just describe, called the Asch conformity experiment. And here the setup is, it was university students. There was a caller at the front of the classroom, and there were five people sitting in a row at the back facing the classroom, the teacher. One of them was the person being experimented on. And the other four were in on it, and what was shown on the screen by the teacher was a single line, a vertical line to the left of the screen, and it had a length. You could see it was short, medium, or long. And on the right-hand side of the screen were three or four lines, I can't remember which, of different lengths. And all you had to do is, when asked, is say which of the lines on the right, A, B, C, or D, was most similar to the standard or test line on the left. And they varied the picture over and over and over again, so it wouldn't always be the same answer. And here's the thing. If the test subject was the last person, the fifth in line to be asked, even though the other four people had given what he knew, or he or she knew was the wrong answer. So say the first line of the four lines on the right was the same as the test line on the left. So the answer is A. Which line is most similar to the line on the left? If all the others said B, 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 most of the time, the final person, the one actually who was really being experimented on, they would look to the left and the right in astonishment, but they would say B. They didn't say, oh no, I may be seeing it wrong, or maybe you've made a mistake, but it's definitely A, sir. They hardly ever did that. And they tested to see what was the compliance rate of peer pressure, really, if you were in the middle of the line of five students, if you were at the end of the line of five students, or if you were the first.
So when they were the first, they gave the correct answer. And then when the other students gave the wrong, what they thought was the wrong answer, you could see they looked just terribly, perplexed, because they could see they had fallen out of social compliance, even though they knew. So they were now in cognitive dissonance. And this is probably what where people who are listening now have been occasionally, if not often. I know I have. So, but if you were in the third, fourth, or fifth position, these people nearly always said the wrong answer, and you could see the stress, but they did it. But there were a few people, I don't know the numbers, I don't remember, but my guess is it's the same proportion. Maybe one in four or one in three people don't readily go along. Something in them that says this is wrong, and they'll get themselves into a bit of trouble. So, and this is the hopeful point. When the person, for example, who refused to go along with it, and they would tell the truth, was, say, in the third position, and they would say that, so the people to their right had said B, B, and they knew it was A, and they said confidently A. The people after them, they tried sometimes to put other people in who were genuinely now test subjects. The test subjects in the fourth or fifth position, if the person to their right gave the correct answer, were much more likely to give the correct answer. What this says is it is worth you standing up in these small things or large things, but certainly even in these small things, if you will stand up courteously and firmly and do the right thing, you give permission to people around you who can see you to do the right thing. So I remember learning this, and I didn't understand the connection to the Ash conformity experiment. Somebody told me that the way to break out of this delusion that I could see deepening as I, as a biologist, a scientist, was looking at what we're being told, and bad things happening. Somebody told me the way to break out of it is to behave normally in others' company. And that's so what I've just described, and I'll close now. You can make a difference, but these are two examples of people going along with the crowd.
Well, I think those are critical examples. And there's actually another element that I want us to address after the break. And that is the fact that in the Milgram experiment and the Ash experiment, the participants were not motivated by fear to do what they did. So I'd like us to talk more about how fear was used during COVID to manipulate people to even greater degrees of conformity. This is Dr. Lee for America with the Whistleblower Report. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back to continue this fascinating discussion about why people do things they know are wrong and hurting someone else. The compliance experiments shed light on it, but there are propaganda tactics that we'll discuss as well. Check out our website at truthforhealth.org and check out our store, truthforhealthstore.com. We have some really exciting products that will help improve your health and resilience. I'm taking many of them myself, and I'm amazed at the difference, both in terms of quality assurance as well as the unique formulations that make the products more effective than what I'd been taking all these years. So check out our store and sign up for our email alerts. And if you can, donate to support our critical work to bring you truth, hope, and solutions against the lies and deception. We'll be right back after the break.
We live in a world full of disinformation, lies, and deceit, often from those institutions and individuals that we used to rely on and trust. In the chaos that surrounds us on a daily basis, it's difficult to find a place for truthful information and helpful guidance. Where can we turn for honest answers, critical solutions, and information that empowers us to be the person that God intended? The Truth for Health Foundation. The Truth for Health Foundation works every day to fight for your basic human rights. We have a track record of providing life-saving emergency actions that can improve your health and empower you with the tools to be safe, happy, and free to live your life. With over 100,000 supporters around the world, we are a critical voice of truth in today's world. We invite you to join our community of financial supporters so that we can continue to be your trusted partner for health, for life, for resilience. Join us today by giving now.
Hello, everyone. This is Lieutenant Mark Bashaw, U.S. Army and legal grant recipient of the Truth for Health Foundation. I want to give a huge shout out to the Truth for Health Foundation for helping me and my family over the past year with our legal battles. Recently, I was court-martialed for not participating with these experimental COVID-19 emergency use authorized products. If it wasn't for Truth for Health Foundation and all the support, I would definitely be in a worse spot. But because of all the support, I'm able to continue uniform service, fighting for what's right to protect the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless America.
Welcome back to the second half of the Whistleblower Report. This is Dr. Lee for America with Dr. Mike Yeadon coming to us from Spain this week and Dr. Jonathan Gilthorpe coming to us from Sweden. Our Croatian investigative journalist, Andrea Klarić, is unable to join us today, but we'll be back next week. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about is the fear factor. Fear was the weapon, more so than a virus, the coronavirus, that I feel strongly we have evidence was manufactured in a laboratory targeted to be more lethal than typical cold coronaviruses, and was actually set up as a bioweapon with the COVID shot being the end goal bioweapon. And what I think is interesting is, why did doctors and nurses go along with the alterations in our normal treatment plans? Many of them did. I didn't. I was treating people the way I thought was medically appropriate. I wasn't going to follow Fauci and the other narratives that were directed to us, because my oath was to my patients, not to Anthony Fauci and the federal government. But the thing that raises that question is, why was that so rapidly instituted? And I think Dr. Yeadon and I both can shed some light on the use of fear as the weapon of control and compliance and intimidation. Dr. Yeadon, you had some thoughts on that.
Yes, certainly. It had occurred to me, certainly during 2020, just watching. I mean, I call it chromatography, is a way of separating, you know, particles of different characteristics, and you push them through a medium, you know, like a gel or an electrical field or something. And I felt very strongly that I, as a human being, was being pushed, as it were, by a force, and I was being chromatographed and basically separated. And I wasn't going to go along with what was happening. And other people did, and they go along with whatever the medium that's being used. And I think that's, these psychological experiments go some way towards explaining. And I think it's kind of an interesting model that people get separated. And I don't genuinely, most of the time, I don't think the conformers, the people following the orders, are particularly evil, even though in the end, they've done evil things. And here's the thing. The Allies were particularly interested, as Jonathan mentioned, post-war, in how had intelligent, aware, ordinary Germans gone along with this. And just in brief, ladies and gentlemen, to cut to the chase, it's a little by little, slippery slope, thin end of the wedge. That's all it took. If you are in a social hierarchy, we've talked about following the laws. Now imagine you understand that if you deviate and won't do this, what seems a reasonably small request initially, right? It's a small request. Making people in supermarkets follow the lane markings on the floor, making them wear a mask. I mean, how harmful can that be? The answer is not very on an individual occasion. But now if you build it up and now you make people queue outside, now you won't take their bank card, or sorry, you'll only take their bank card, you won't take cash. Gradually, you are sliced away. And now you realize, if you would even wake up, that you're somehow complicit, but everybody else is, you don't know how to get out of it. And then imagine on top of that, you're told your professional accreditation will be questioned if you don't administer the vaccines or force people to take this test, whatever. Imagine furthermore that the university or hospital administrators say, this is so important that we've been offered incentives to do it, so that if you do diagnose a patient, if you do have to put them on a vent, then you know, we'll get $13,000. And if they should die here, well, despite our trying to save them, we get $39,000, provided the diagnosis is COVID. I am not kidding, ladies and gentlemen. Those were incentives. So they were paid, the hospitals were offered money to comply, and the individuals were personally threatened. In my country, in England, I know many doctors who resisted, and they have been eventually gone through professional standards and struck off. So you were threatened if you didn't comply. You were heavily incentivized and rewarded if you did. And then we've got this social conformity. So just a couple of things to say. There's one, and I'm going to send the link so we can put it. A guy called Milton Meyer, who I think is an American German, and he was so intrigued by trying to find what the hell had happened that he traveled to post-war Germany and interviewed several dozen professionals, university lecturers, you know, senior engineers and so on. And he wrote a book called They Thought They Were Free, the Germans, 1933 to 1945. And it's worth reading little pieces, and we will send you an excerpt, because I remember people telling me when I was young that, you know, bad things happened in Germany, but the Brits wouldn't do this, you know, bulldog spirit and so on. And I say BS. We are just as, if you're in that same force field, most people will do the same thing. But the one thing I wanted just to mention was this, and this is, it's a long quote, which I won't read the long quote. This is a university lecturer describing in anguish to this interviewer, Milton Meyer. And he says, to quote, "To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me. Unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness or acuity than most of us ever had occasion to develop, each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted, that unless you were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was to be in principle, what these little measures that no patriotic German would resent must someday lead to. No more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day it is over his head." And I remember when I read that, and you can tell it's affected me, I remember stopping. And I cried, because I thought, this is what's happening to my country and around the world. And I could see these little step by step, the daily news, we would have public service experts, you know, public health experts, and a senior politician, and often standing with them might be an army person, for goodness sake, or a policeman or somebody. So you've got the authority figures, you've got the scientists with their ties, you got the politician wringing their hands and telling you what to do. And each day they would keep the fear going, and they would keep making you do small things. And what reasonable patriotic Brit would not go along with washing your hands or staying away from people, you know, and before you know it, it's over your head. That's really what I wanted to say. And it's worth reading that book, or even just a piece of it online. Because here's the thing that I my gut, my judge, my guess is the very fact, ladies and gentlemen, that you are listening to this show means one, you're aware something very bad is happening, and two, you're motivated to try and understand it. And my guess is you don't want the world to go in this direction, and you're willing to do something. Well, that's all it takes. The Solomon Asch experiments, it showed that if you do whatever you can where you are with what you've got, stand up. You know, you don't have to be a massive hero, but just what happens is when people witnessing other people doing the right thing, when people witness other people doing the right thing, they're apt to conform to it, just as if they only witness bad behavior they follow. So we can all make a difference, and I think we should.
And I think we are seeing that as more and more people do not comply with these draconian measures and are waking up as they see the in-your-face, blatant lawlessness, evil, and assault on life and freedom and the climate and animals and everything else. I mean, we just got a notice from Representative Thomas Massey in the United States House of Representatives. He posted last week a shocking finding hidden in the omnibus bill, a funding bill in the United States being rammed through Congress. Lobbyists got $15 million to implement electronic tracking of all cattle in the United States. There is no law that authorizes that. It is horrific in terms of the beginning of carrying out the globalist agenda to eliminate meat, slaughter cattle, to reduce our beef supply. We're already running at the lowest beef supply since, for the last, I think, since World War II, actually. And this is going to be used by the Marxist control freaks and the green agenda to limit beef production, and the corporate meat companies, the big industrial ones, are using it to dominate small ranchers. And it goes to Bill Gates's bragging about eliminating beef and pushing the C40 agenda in cities across America, where you won't be allowed to eat meat at all. It was very chilling to see that this was already being slipped into the omnibus bill. And to me, it ties in to the things you were talking about, Dr. Yeadon, that if we don't stand up on the little steps, then it's the slippery slope to the bigger ones. And you had another comment you wanted to add to all of this.
Yes. Just as Dr. Gilthorpe earlier said, he's not a psychologist. I will put my hands up and say I'm a biologist and a broad experimentalist. I'm not a climate science expert, nor am I a demographer, so I'm not an expert in human population. But I tell you what, I can read, and I have done. So why did I mention those two things? If you think back, ladies and gentlemen, over the last 50 years, perhaps a little more, I put it to you that we have all been programmed to believe a couple of things about the world. One is that we're boiling the world, we're heating up the climate, and it's all our fault. And that climate change crisis level, climate change, that's not true. I have found my peers, you know, people with 30 or 40 years experience in their field, speaking truth, and they've all been censored and smeared. But you know, Professor Judith Curry, Professor Richard Lindzen, and there are half a dozen others, including the person who won the Nobel Prize for Physics the year before last. So these are proper people. And, you know, they're very measured in their response, but they've said, what you're being told is a gross exaggeration, and we don't think, even at the most extreme future outcomes, that there's any basis to believe what you're being told. So I'm not going to try and lecture you on climate change, although I've done personally enough work to be able to give a half an hour talk on it with competence. But my point is that for 50 years, it's been rammed into your head and your children and your workmates that the climate is warming and it's our fault. And there's one other thing which has moved in parallel and has received a lot less attention, but here it is. I think you'll have heard it. And it's that the world is overpopulated. There's too many of us, that scenes of teeming people are shown periodically, and that, yeah, the world is overpopulated, that we're beyond the carrying capacity of this good earth. And ladies and gentlemen, I know in terms of the first one, the climate change, it's a lie. I'm not given to fancy flight to fancy, but I've read enough and spoken to my peers who I've identified, and it's not true. And basically, just as I've been censored for talking about inappropriate testing, inappropriate development of so-called vaccines, because that's what I did for a living, 35 years. Nobody arrested me or harmed me, but they just turned off my ability to reach people through the internet. I believe that bad people have been planning to do whatever they're doing for at least that period of time, because there's been money that's been poured into a field that didn't exist when they started. There was no such thing as climate science. It might be atmospheric physics and so on, weather forecasting and so on. But significant money has been put in to create the narrative and to reward the people whose research findings support the narrative, to provide funding to those whose research proposals look like they'll run down that line, and frankly, and to push out, to not promote and punish those people who go, well, wait a minute, this isn't true. And I think they've done that on climate science, and they've done it on overpopulation. And this is my hypothesis as to why they have done that. Periodically, people in each of their professions wake up to the fact that what they're doing is not just harming people, but killing them. And I think many, I can't believe there are very many in healthcare that haven't realized that these vaccines, in these injections are harmful. And when they extrapolate around the world, it must be a lot of people. And I think in the back of their mind, it's, well, we humans are destroying this beautiful world, and there are too many of us. Now, I don't think either of those things are true, but just imagine how powerful that is. I've been written to twice at home, by religious people who told me that, unfortunately, we've made such a mess of God's creation that it's not surprising this punishment is being brought upon our heads. And several times, I would say several times a week online, wherever I'm involved in a discussion below an article, there'll be somebody who will say that you don't want to hear this, but there are too many of us. You know, I just wanted to mention those things because someone put considerable effort in, and I kind of now think I know why they did, because it stops people doing the right thing.
I think you're correct on that. And that ties in with something Dr. Gilthorpe and the three of us were talking about before the show, and that is the seasonality of deaths and the fact that the climate change alteration, sun dimming, weather modification, creating more gray, cloudy days in the winter is affecting people's health on many levels. And that is leading, I think, to some of this seasonality in the death rates. Dr. Gilthorpe, why don't you explain more about the data that you were discussing on that? And then we can talk about some of the factors that contribute to it.
Yeah, certainly, Dr. Lee. Yeah, thank you, Mike. I mean, it's very interesting. And one thing I would just like to add to that, so that everyone is aware, we are programmed from a very early age, you know, more or less from birth, through the school system, particularly through the TV and the media. And much of this is subliminal. So we don't know, we're not aware of it. But you'll see that if you watch, you know, some kind of Hollywood movie or TV show, you'll see frequent product placement in in the set. You know, there'll be a Starbucks coffee cup, or there'll be a coffee cup in every scene, and these things are used to programmers. There's a lot, great deal of thought goes into this, so nobody should think they're immune from this. We're very susceptible, but our basic things that we, I mean, as humans, we make decisions based on two things: avoidance of pain, as we saw in the Milgram experiment. I think part of the reason that person was pressing the buzzer was because he thought that, you know, if he did it, he wouldn't suffer the pain that the other person was suffering. And the other thing is seeking pleasure. This is the dopamine reward response that, you know, we get from drinking alcohol, from socializing, from eating nice food, from flipping on social media. This is all dopamine wired. So those two things are used to steer us, and we're very susceptible to those because they're extremely powerful. Anyway, back on track to the seasonality of death, Dr. Lee. Well, there was a post from Ed Dowd this week that showed that a particular form of neuroendocrine tumor showed a very similar seasonal pattern to what I knew about seasonal deaths related to, you know, what's usually attributed to the flu or to respiratory viruses. You know, people die, more people die in the autumn and winter time. There's a peak around January. If you look in the southern hemisphere, it's flipped. And this was often put down to, you know, the flu season. People would get coughs and colds, and they'd be put under stress, and they're more likely to die in the winter time, particularly as you get older and older. But seeing the same pattern for neuroendocrine tumors suddenly made me realize, okay, it's not just you know, flu season or low vitamin D. This is death in general. So people are more likely to die in the winter time. Well, why is that? Well, it's the sun. You know, it's the lack of sunlight. And I don't think you can put this all down to vitamin D, because many people take vitamin D supplements. Many people go away in the summer, you know, in the wintertime, forget some winter sun. So it's a very reproducible pattern that you see. And I think it's much more related to the beneficial effects of sunlight, which go way further than just vitamin D. It's important for the programming of our circadian clock through the retina. We have receptors that pick up sunlight and train all the cells in your body to run on the right time schedule. And at wintertime, you know, that will be less accurate. And there are many other beneficial effects of sunlight. And for me, I suddenly clicked. Why are they investing so much time and energy in weather modification? Well, I think that is because with this depopulation agenda, one of the easiest ways to kill the, you know, the most people without them really realizing it, which is what they're trying to do, would be to reduce sunlight. And because then, you know, people will die at a higher rate. It's kind of like the COVID jabs that have a very non-specific mechanism of action. They kill people through myocarditis, or heart inflammation, through blood clots, through increased risk of cancer. So it's not one cause. And if it isn't one cause, it's much harder for people to realize what's going on. So yeah, that's my realization this week. And I think it suddenly, you know, makes more sense now why you mentioned, Dr. Lee, this kind of spraying of the air at daily basis. I mean, it's a huge amount of cost and expense and time involved in doing that. Why would you do that just to put chemicals into the air? And some people hypothesize that it's, you know, behavior modification through whatever they're spraying, but I think it's more clearly for me, it's weather modification. And why would you do that? I think it's dimming the sun.
Well, and I think that does contribute to the depopulation agenda. They are using as many different approaches to world depopulation as they can
Get
devise
away with.
and get away with in their diabolical, evil, Machiavellian minds and the strategies they're employing, and then coercing people to carry them out. No, you're exactly right. The beneficial effects of sunlight, that is a powerful statement, go way beyond just vitamin D. It absolutely does. And when you think about the enormity of altering the entire endocrine system through the neuroendocrine control mechanisms triggered by sunlight, then you realize how subtle and how devious and diabolical this plan is to dim the sunlight. And it not only affects humans, it's clearly affecting the growth of plants. It's affecting animals and animal behavior and their circadian rhythms, their reproductive cycle. I mean, all of these things are very sensitive to sunlight, the photo period, the length of the photo period every day, and the intensity of the sunlight. So it is a staggering impact. And sometimes I look at the beautiful world that God created, and I look up at the sky on a sunny day, and I just think, Lord, how can human beings whom you created be so evil as to destroy your beautiful design of all life and our climate and the planet itself? It's truly staggering.
Yes, it is, Dr. Lee. I mean, it's stepwise, isn't it? And we need to turn around and reverse the process. But I think on the other side, from we've been talking about these psychological experiments. Perhaps we don't have time to go into this too much today, but there's also another battery of psychological experiments that were done in the 80s, 90s, and beyond, which looked at the ability of humans to affect a random outcome. So just a quick summary of those experiments. So if you have an instrument or a machine that generates a random outcome, what you can do is use their intent to change the outcome. So let's say it's turning on a light. They could try to suppress that light being turned on, or they could get it to be turned on more often. And those experiments show very clearly, actually, that humans have the ability to affect the outcome of a process by positive thought, by showing love or care or attention. And if you connect two people into that experiment, so the outcome is dependent on the interaction between the two of them, they can actually make the outcome much greater between them rather than one person alone. Particularly if those two people have met before and they've kind of interacted, looked in each other's eyes, they can exceed the rate of chance or the rate of a single person affecting the experiment by a tremendous amount. Interestingly, some specific people can block the effect, but what I want to say is that, you know, what we think and what we feel and how we act can actually influence the outcome of processes. This is not pseudoscience. This has been shown through multiply repeated experiments with very high degree of statistical significance. So it's not all bad news. We can make the world a better place, and I think we're doing it. But we just need everyone to think positively and to realize that we are being guided into a future which none of us want to live in. So we need to do something about it.
And that's a beautiful summary and conclusion for today. Thank you, Dr. Gilthorpe. Positive action, positive thoughts, and interactions with others out of love and caring. And isn't that the fundamental principle of the Bible and what we've been taught our whole lives in the Judeo-Christian traditions? And God tells us to turn back to Him and live our lives under His commandments and showing love for our neighbor as we do for ourselves. And I think that's a good message for all of us. Thank you both for joining us today. And for all of you listening, share the Whistleblower Report with your friends and your community. Help other people understand what is happening, why it's happening, and what you can do about it to turn things around for a more positive and happier outcome and life for all of us. This is Dr. Lee for America. We'll be back again next week with another international report with our wonderful team, Dr. Eden, Dr. Gilthorpe, and Andrea Klarich. Thank you for joining us today.